Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Welcome to Sound Practice. I'm Mike Tsakopoulos. For more than three decades, my guest today has covered nearly every corner of the healthcare industry, from managed care to information technology to now the question of how we make healthcare affordable for everyone. His new book, Beyond Medicare for All, Cracking the Code of the Healthcare Affordability Crisis, is published by the American Association for Physician Leadership, the sponsor of this podcast. This book lays out a bold new plan for restructuring the U.S. healthcare system, one built around empowering primary care physicians, a defined role for insurers and hospitals, and a novel approach to deciding what care gets covered. Buckle up. We're looking at the nuts and bolts of our healthcare system next on Sound Practice. Terry's new book, Beyond Medicare for All, Cracking the Code of the Healthcare Affordability Crisis, is published by the American Association for Physician Leadership, the sponsor of this podcast. Ken Terry, welcome to Sound Practice.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure to get to speak with you. Now, Ken, before we jump into the new book, I'm interested to know how you came to the healthcare field.
I came to the healthcare field actually through a friend of mine who was working in medical economics. And at the time, I was looking for a journalism job, and he gave me some freelance opportunities, and they liked my writing and they hired me. And, you know, at that point, I was out of the frying pan into the fire. I had a lot to learn.
It is complex indeed. Well, I'm excited to talk about your new book. The book, as I mentioned, is Beyond Medicare for All, Cracking the Code of the Healthcare Affordability Crisis. And I'm interested to know, why did you write the book?
Well, this is actually the third book that I've written on healthcare reform. And I have been building this model for over 20 years. You know, based on a number of things I had observed in the field and studies that I had read. And, you know, I just really felt that we needed to have a different approach to healthcare reform that emphasized primary care and that, you know, tried to, you know, provide universal healthcare that was high quality and affordable to all. My earlier books assumed that we would someday have Medicare for All, and that would be the overarching financing mechanism for the system. But I came to realize that that will probably never happen. And therefore, we need to find some approach to restructuring the system that meets the needs of the major industry players.
You started to mention this, but I'm interested. Why should primary care physicians be in charge of basic care, including lower level specialty services, and how would that help save primary care?
Okay, well, just going up one level from that, physicians should have a greater role in running healthcare overall, since they're the ones who diagnose and treat patients and know where the waste is. Primary care doctors should oversee basic care because they're trained to deliver preventive and chronic care and to coordinate care with specialists. Moreover, if PCPs deliver all the care that they're capable of, they won't have to refer out the specialists as much as they do now. But primary care has been declining as fewer young doctors go into it and more older doctors retire. Just in the past decade, the percentage of U.S. doctors in primary care has dropped from about a third to a quarter. During the same time period, the majority of PCPs became employed by health systems and corporations. If they could be liberated from that employment and form groups large enough to be financially responsible for basic care, primary care physicians could save healthcare while earning more and restoring prestige to their field.
And what are your thoughts on physician assistants and nurse practitioners? How do they fit into this model?
Well, they're essential because right now we don't have enough primary care doctors, and the EMPs and PAs are delivering a great deal of the primary care in the country. But we have to remember that they're not substitutes for primary care physicians. It's said that they can provide 85 to 90% of the care that a primary care doctor does. But even if that's true, that 10 or 15% can be really critical. And, you know, as some primary care doctors have told me, you know, PAs and NPs can't necessarily determine, you know, what's wrong with a patient when they come in exhibiting equivocal symptoms.
So I'm very interested in your model, and your model involves a system of competing primary care groups. But most physicians, as you just mentioned, are employed today. Mm-hmm. How would you address that situation?
Okay, well, to allow the creation of this model, the federal government would have to restructure the healthcare system pursuant to an act of Congress. But the states could implement changes in the employment status of primary care doctors. Today, 33 states and the District of Columbia have what are known as corporate practice of medicine laws, which are designed to prevent the corporate employment of doctors. Now, these states aren't preventing health systems or insurers or private equity firms from employing primary care doctors, but they could, and other states could do the same.
And would that be done through the legislature, through boards of medicine, all of the above?
It would be done through the legislature. States would have to pass a law saying that, basically, they would have to beef up their current corporate practice of medicine laws in the ways that I talk about, but it would only apply to primary care doctors.
So we know that lots of this comes down to money, which brings me immediately to third-party payers. Mm-hmm. Insurance companies, how do you believe that they would support mm-hmm. or favor your model?
Well, I think that they, and as well as you know, the majority of corporations that self-insure today, realize that the system is headed for collapse. They know that it's unsustainable. And the insurance companies oppose Medicare for All because it would cut them out, obviously. And they also don't support a public option, which they know would lead to Medicare for All. But in the model I'm proposing, insurers would have an important role. First of all, they would cover everything outside of basic care, including inpatient care, post-acute care, and the more expensive types of ambulatory care, such as cancer care and outpatient surgery. They would also cover everyone, including all Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries for those types of care. And so they would pick up all of the Medicare beneficiaries who are not now members of Medicare Advantage plans. And all in all, their business model would remain strong.
So under your model, hospitals would charge every payer the same for the same service, and they would have global budgets, as in Maryland. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't hospitals fight this change tooth and nail?
Well, the first part of the answer is the same as for insurers. The current system is unsustainable, and eventually there won't be enough money to cover hospital costs if most people can't afford healthcare. The Maryland system of all-payer hospital rates and global budgets has worked well for both insurers and hospitals. And it could work elsewhere, as Ezekiel Emanuel and his colleagues have pointed out in Health Affairs. If hospitals had global budgets, they would also not be subject to prior authorization rules. Their physicians would figure out how best to deliver high-quality care within a budget, and a hospital's budget would be negotiated with their state.
What happens in rural areas?
That's a good question. Rural healthcare is different from suburban and urban healthcare in many ways. The most important difference is the scarcity of hospitals and medical clinics in rural areas. Because there aren't many doctors, or in some cases, any doctors, you couldn't form the kind of competing groups that would exist in more populated areas. So I talked to a bunch of rural doctors and experts and came up with a modified version of my model for rural healthcare. The financing piece would be split in two, just as in the mainstream model. But the determination of whether the care would be covered by a basic care subscription or by an insurance company would depend on where the care was delivered rather than what kind of care was delivered. If a patient was treated in a rural hospital, primary care clinic, or a federally qualified health center, the care would be would fall under a state-negotiated global budget for the local healthcare system. If a rural resident were treated in a metropolitan hospital or outpatient center, their care would be covered by major medical insurance.
With the competing groups, let's take an urban or suburban area, and we have, under your model, competing primary care groups. Would a family be able to have some members at one group, primary care group, and other family members go to the competitor?
You know, I think that would create some major problems. I didn't consider that in my book, but, you know, clearly you'd want to have family premiums or individual premiums. And, you know, if you're going to, first of all, a family premium for a family of four, say, would probably be much less expensive than four individual premiums. So I think this probably would be covered by the fact that people would not want to spend that much money. But right. In any case, you know, we should remember that the distinguishing characteristic of primary care is that it covers people from birth to death. And so all members of the family could receive you know, adequate care, you know, obviously differentiated by whether it's, you know, pediatric care or family medicine or internal medicine.
Would the day of a primary care physician be different under your model than what they experience today?
Yes, it would be very different. First of all, the physicians in my primary care groups would be paid salaries. So they wouldn't have to, you know, what they were doing on a day-to-day basis would have no bearing on how much money they earned. The only bonuses would be based on quality and stewardship of resources. But in addition, they would be working in care teams designed to manage population health, in which the health of not only the individual patient, but the overall population would be the paramount goal. And this would include not only office visits, but, you know, also all the in-between visit care that is required to keep people healthy or to prevent chronic illnesses from becoming worse. So I think that the primary care physician would be acting more like the quarterback of the team. They would have an individual relationship with each patient, and they would see them when they came in for visits, but they would also be directing the team in ways that would benefit you know, the long-term health of the patient and population health.
As you know, we are experiencing the aging of the baby boomer generation. They're requiring more health care. Would your model accommodate that in a better fashion than what we're seeing today?
Well, yes and no. On the positive side, all the things that I was talking about, better chronic disease care would definitely help older patients, many of whom have multiple chronic diseases. And doctors be able to spend more time with each patient and really find out what was wrong with them. So that would all be positive. On the other side, I considered the challenge of long-term care, and I really couldn't come up with anything that would really work better than the system we have right now, at least in terms of the financing anyway. And as you know, right now, it's a limited amount of coverage by Medicare, mainly in dual eligible patients and only for professional services. And the rest of it, really goes to Medicaid and whatever resources the families might have. It's a very challenging subject and one that other countries have not really come up with good answers for.
It is challenging, and there are not lots of good answers and certainly no happy answers, right?
Right.
To that issue. You speak about, and you cover this in your book, about new technologies and a consumer council. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and why you would advocate for one, what it would do?
All right. But once again, let me just take one step back and try to put this in a framework. Right now, as you know, Medicare is not allowed to consider cost in its coverage determinations. Okay. But we need, there are other countries that do, and we need to start considering that, because if there's no limit on what new medical technologies can be covered, no matter how expensive they are, the health system is losing vital resources that could be used to provide basic care that most people need. And so if you think, well, which is a better use of those resources, an exorbitantly expensive drug that might benefit relatively few people or extend their lives by a relatively short amount of time, or chronic care for people with diabetes, hypertension, or heart failure, or prenatal and maternity care? Somehow society must devise a mechanism to make such decisions in a democratic way. It can't just be left to the imperatives of the free market. So starting from those assumptions, went back to the section that ended my first book, and it was based on a conversation that I had with David Eddy. I believe he wrote an article on this too. David Eddy was a population health advisor to Kaiser Permanente, among others, and an expert in clinical guidelines. And his idea was that, if we really wanted to apportion healthcare resources in a fair democratic way, then we should have some kind of a consumer council of people who had to pay for their own insurance, and that somehow a way could be devised to show them how much their insurance premiums were likely to go up if a given technology were adopted and assume that it costs a certain amount and that it will be used by a certain number of people in the future. His insight was that, people would probably not think about so much about the likelihood that they might have this rare disease someday that, the new drug could mitigate, but that they would have to pay so much more for their insurance premium every year. And, how would they weigh that, right? I mean, obviously, it gets more complicated with other things too, like GLP-1 drugs that, sure, aren't super expensive, but that, are used by millions of people, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, the UK has had a citizens' council, something like this. At one time, it really had a major impact on the decisions of the National Health Service on, you know, what technologies should be covered. You know, over the past 10 years, I'd say that has pretty much declined, and you know, they're just called in, particularly people who have had a particular condition. They're called in to, as advisors. In any case, you know, this is only one idea that might be considered and debated, but I do think we need to have some way of determining what is worth covering, because otherwise there is no way that we're going to be able to limit the spending of our healthcare system.
Any ideas on how many people would be on a council or how that would operate? I like the idea, right? Very democratic, and you'd involve the actual consumer who feels cut out of the process currently.
Yeah.
But I also think about what it's like to go in Walmart at 10 p.m. on a Thursday, and I'm not sure I want those people making decisions for my health care. Yeah. It's difficult.
It is. And I would say probably somewhere between several hundred and several thousand people on such a body, and we would look for people who had some amount of college education, so, you know, some knowledge of healthcare. They would be provided with consumer friendly descriptions of the technology and the likely results of using it and covering it, they would serve for limited terms. They would also be anonymous, by the way, so that nobody could pressure them or get to them in any way. And, you know, they would have to be somewhat public-spirited, because they would have to be, you know, devoting some portion of their time to considering, you know, these questions. So, you know, I'm not sure, you know, how you would choose the members of this consumer council, but I don't think it would be at random.
Fair enough. Do you believe that your model, the system, could be implemented on a statewide basis, or would it need to be a national model?
Well, it would need to be a national restructuring of healthcare, because you know, people, you know, seek care across state boundaries. Businesses have offices across state boundaries, and I know some states have tried to do, you know, Medicare for all, you know, just within their state. Massachusetts, you know, famously did the precursor to the Affordable Care Act all by itself, and that actually did have some good effects, but it was, you know, still only about you know, financing healthcare. I do think that, you know, it has to be established by the federal government, you know, and certain rules have to be set. However, first of all, the states would have an important role, certainly in regulating the hospital market. They're the ones who would be negotiating, you know, with the hospitals, and probably doing statewide report cards on the hospitals. Also, there's a role for a new regional health authority, which is, you know, again, in some ways similar to what you have in the UK. But these regional health authorities would be regulating the competition among the basic care groups. They would consist of representatives from consumers, businesses, and physicians. And they would hire what I call health utilities, you know, which would be like, you know, third party companies, you know, that would have, you know, certain rules that they would have to follow as well. But they would regulate the competition among the basic care groups. They would, if a group fell apart for some reason, they would make sure that the physicians in that group were apportioned among the other groups in the area. They would do report cards on the quality and patient experience of those groups. And to the extent that that there were claims for services by specialists and labs and so forth, they would process those clamps.
Very interesting. You've put a lot of creative thought into this, and I'm very excited for people to read the book and discuss this. But I have to ask, as our time together runs out, with a new book that's just come out, what's next on your agenda?
Well, I think my wife hopes this is my last book, but because it takes so much of my time. But I think that right now, what I would like to do is to promote the ideas in this book and to forward them eventually to the staffs of the healthcare, the chairs of the healthcare committees after the election. And I assume that we will have a Democratic Congress after that election. And also to the campaigns of 2028 presidential candidates. And I just hope that, you know, somebody will pick this up, or at least try to find out more.
I certainly hope so as well. My guest has been Ken Terry. His new book, which the audience should go forth and read because it has excellent ideas in it. That book is Beyond Medicare for All, Cracking the Code of the Healthcare Affordability Crisis. Ken Terry, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
It's our absolute pleasure. Thank you, sir. My thanks to Ken Terry. His new book, Beyond Medicare for All, Cracking the Code of the Healthcare Affordability Crisis, is now available from the American Association for Physician Leadership. If today's conversation got you thinking about what healthcare reform could look like, we'd encourage you to pick up a copy and see where you land. Thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Holy cow, Batman and Robin, Rick Capow.